Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, August 9, 2016. Church leaders welcome a proposal for deployment of regional protection force in South Sudan.
We are happy that the regional bodies are joining us, supporting us all through. This will give us a platform to be able to carry on our mission of reconciliation, because that is the major difficulties we have at the moment.
And China agrees to give South Sudan $2 billion for development projects.
Anything above 50 million would be a concessional loan. All the projects that we presented to China total around $1.9 billion.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Church leaders in South Sudan have welcomed the proposed deployment of a regional protection force in the country, adding that the force should be deployed immediately to save the lives of civilians. The IGAD Plus countries are asking the UN Security Council to empower UN peacekeepers in South Sudan to protect civilians. Tito Justin reports for VOA from Juba.
Church leaders from across the country's Christian various denominations approved President Salva Kiir's decision to accept a proposal by IGAD heads of state to deploy a regional protection force to South Sudan to keep the peace in the country. The Catholic Auxiliary Bishop of Juba Archdiocese, Santo Laku Pio, says church leaders feared what might happen to the peace agreement if an outside force was not sent in. Bishop Loku describes the move as a breakthrough for South Sudan, saying it will enable the country to achieve peace and move forward in resolving other challenges, including the economic crisis, widespread insecurity, and ethnic clashes.
We are happy that the regional bodies are joining us, supporting us all through. This will give us a platform to be able to carry on our mission of reconciliation, because that is the major difficulties we have at the moment.
Bishop Loku says South Sudan have suffered enough. The leader of the African Inland Church says partners in the transitional government of national unity should work out any remaining issues to restore peace. Bishop Archangelo Wanilem says civilians across South Sudan need protection.
Everybody is afraid for their own life. And so the protection force, whatever the government is saying, I would still say they should be dialogue engaged in all this. And if possible, even maybe engage with the church in this.
Bishop Loku says dialogue is the only way to restore peace and security and rebuild the collapsing economy.
All that is happening, it should be done through peaceful means. No violence can bring about peace. At all. Whatever attacks they do on the road, whatever attacks they do anywhere else, in the rural areas, whoever is behind that, should listen to the voice of peace and reconciliation in the country so that the development could kick off.
Yesterday, women's group said ordinary citizens do not trust the country's army and appealed to the government and the regional bloc IGAD to ensure that the proposed protection force is deployed across the country. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin, in Juba.
The opposition coalition known as Sudan Call signed a roadmap agreement last night in Addis Ababa to end the war in Darfur, Blue Nile and Southern Kordofan, and join President Omar al-Bashir's dialogue in Khartoum. The group includes the Umma Party of Sadiq al-Mahdi, the armed rebel group of SPLA North in South Kordofan and Blue Nile, and the Darfur-based Justice and Equality Movement, along with the Sudan Liberation Movement, Mini Minawi Faction. Nabil Biajo has more for VOA from Khartoum.
In his address to the 6th National Dialogue General Assembly over the weekend, President Bashir set a date for the National Dialogue's General Conference of October 10th. In 2014, Mr. Bashir promised comprehensive political and economic reforms following widespread protests against his regime on the streets of Khartoum and other cities across Sudan. The protests were brutally repressed by Sudanese National Security Forces, resulting in the deaths of more than 200 civilians, according to Amnesty International. Speaking in Arabic, President Bashir says it's time to turn the page. He says, it's been more than 2.5 years since we started this project in January 2014, through which we intended to pull our national efforts together to effect comprehensive reform to put our country back on the right track. The dialogue began in August 2015 when six committees were set up to conduct discussions with various opposition political parties and former rebel groups, all of which agreed to sign a peace agreement with the government. Mr. Bashir says the committees focus on improving the economy, basic freedoms, good governance and peace. He says, the first track of our project focuses on reforming the political environment on the level of the political parties, its programs, its stances and practices through a national dialogue to achieve a political consensus that puts national interests ahead of party interests. Mr. Bashir insists that the committees charged with taking up various issues of national concern have made significant progress. He says, our efforts have been successful. We convened the dialogue conference through the six committees that we set up in August 2015. This will be marked as the most remarkable event in recent Sudanese political history. Beside the political dialogue, the government also engaged civil society groups such as women and youth groups in communal dialogue intended to restore harmony among different communities. Political commentator Haj Hamad says it's true that many opposition groups voiced their concerns and recommendations for genuine reform during the dialogue, but he says the government has still been trying to silence some of those voices.
In most of the committees, there are a lot of controversial issues and the heavy hand of the security and the hardliners, especially of the so-called
Hamad says the government must keep the demands of the various political groups in the final document to be presented at the General Conference next month. Hamad says this would prove the government can be taken seriously when it talks about political reform.
To put together the same recommendations put by the different committees, especially the Committee on Basic Freedoms, which is totally unacceptable for the national security.
Hamad says the most important part of the ongoing national dialogue will be when the recommendations are presented by the Committee on Basic Social and Political Freedoms.
This is a very pivotal approach. Makes a real difference between a totalitarian system and a regime that is interested to moderate itself and reoriented towards democracy. This is a real crossroads for the region.
The recommendations and resolutions of the six committees are expected to be adopted at the General Conference next month. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio.
South Sudanese Foreign Affairs Minister Deng Alord says China has agreed to lend South Sudan nearly $2 billion to increase the country's oil production and build infrastructure. The terms of the loan were not revealed to reporters in the capital. Tito Justin has the story for VOA from Juba.
Minister Alord, who returned from China yesterday, told reporters in Juba today that South Sudan's oil production has dropped significantly from last year's levels, putting additional pressures on an already struggling economy. Alord did not specify how much crude South Sudan is exporting at the moment or how many barrels the country produces per day, but confirmed China will lend South Sudan money to be used for oil production.
We asked them to increase the production, because as you know, the production where oil now has gone down. And of course, the international price also, the international oil price also has also gone down. And this is making it very difficult for us because oil is the only major resource for South Sudan.
During the 2014 Afro-China Summit, Benjin pledged to provide $60 billion to African countries in three phases. South Sudan is receiving the largest share of $20 billion China is loaning to African countries this year. Alor says the money will be transferred from China to South Sudan through China's Export-Import Bank. He says the government will also use some of the money to invest in education, health, and road infrastructure.
Anything above $50 million would be concessional loan. All the projects that we presented to China totaled around $1.9 billion.
South Sudan's Foreign Affairs Ministry recently issued an order for all foreign diplomats and officials planning travel to the country to notify the government about their planned entry 72 hours in advance. But Alor says, due to Benjin's generosity, the government will not require Chinese nationals traveling to South Sudan to notify the government about their planned entry in advance. And he says, the government will provide the Chinese with protection and will protect all their investments in the country.
The focus of the security situation, as I said, and they were very much in concern about the security and the protection of the Chinese in this country. We have many Chinese companies and Chinese citizens, Chinese nationals who are in South Sudan, and the Chinese government wanted to make sure that these people are secured and that their companies are also secured.
China is the largest investor in South Sudan's oil sector, the single most important source of government revenue. Two Chinese peacekeepers were killed and five others were wounded during the July violence in Juba. For VN News, I am Tiro Justin in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we look at breastfeeding campaign in former Eastern Equatoria State. More on that when we come back.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
if you could travel free in Africa, where would you most like to go?
To me, I think Rwanda. Rwanda, in fact, I just love the name Rwanda, personally. Secondly, I do always hear that in Rwanda, there are very many beautiful ladies there. There are very many beautiful places there.
Kenya, because I think there are nice tourists there. And Obama is from Kenya, so yeah.
I would choose Nigeria for the reasons being that there is oil there.
I think I would prefer to go to West Africa. West Africa, because I really think it's a place which has a lot of opportunities to exploit.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment. Today we are talking about breastfeeding. Hundreds of women in Torit marked World Breastfeeding Day yesterday, a day meant to remind all mothers about the importance of breastfeeding for the health of their children. Health officials say one of the contributing factors to the soaring malnutrition rate is the fact that most children do not get enough breast milk. Dimo Silva Aurelio has more for VOA from Torit.
Exclusive breastfeeding is the concern.
Hundreds of women gathered at Torit Municipality to mark the International Breastfeeding Week under the theme "Breastfeeding is a Key to Sustainable Development." On the International Breastfeeding Day, health officials try to educate mothers on the importance of breast milk for a healthy child. The practice of exclusive breastfeeding is seen by most health officials as economical because it enables a child to develop strong immunities, which helps a child fight off illnesses. Rose Lake says she has breastfed her child for more than 6 months upon the advice of health officials.
and is happy her child is healthy.
Since delivery, I have taken my child to the doctor once, only for flu when he was under 6 months because of the weather. He did not test anything for 6 months, only breast milk, and have never got diarrhea, cough, no malaria or any sickness. I have also kept him under treated mosquito net.
Betty Sebastian, another mother who attended yesterday's event, says despite living with HIV, the practice of exclusive breastfeeding has saved the lives of her two children.
I have two children now, and all of them are very healthy, and the one I have now is 9 months old and is still on breastfeeding. So the first thing I did in my, well, the time I delivered in the hospital. So the first thing I do is to give breastfeeding. Not anything apart from breastfeeding. So that baby took breastfeeding for the last 6 months exclusively without food, water, no. So it's like my child is very healthy and is not even sick. I'm proud to say that my child didn't feel sick for the last 7 to 8 months. So my first treatment I gave to my child was at the age of 9 months, which is very good. Economically, it is affordable. So
health officials say the number of malnourished children getting nutritional food at state hospitals is reduced due to increased awareness on the importance of breast milk. Rachel Awadia Odong, Imotong State Director of Nutrition, says exclusive breastfeeding also reduces the time women would waste visiting the hospital. Speaking in Arabic, she says they also save money.
If a child is breastfed well, the woman will not be absent from her workplace and will do office duty because the child will not be sick and the money she would have spent for treatment is saved for other purposes. And while in her office, she will concentrate.
Our dear says mothers should also keep their children clean during the first 6 months. Raham Kimani, Save the Children's Nutrition Manager, says breastfeeding babies also improves their mental skills.
Some of the benefits of breastfeeding to the children include boosted immunity that makes them irresistible to diseases. It boosts their intelligent quotient, so we have good students who understand what they are learning in school.
Kimani says all health workers must help mothers to breastfeed exclusively and engage communities in promoting this life-saving initiative to move the country toward becoming a healthy nation.
As health workers, we should encourage our mothers to breastfeed immediately the baby comes out, and it should be continued from 6 months up to 2 years and beyond, together with other complementary food.
The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, distributed hundreds of insecticide-treated mosquito bed nets to all breastfeeding mothers during the event. Bed nets are a good way to stop the spread of malaria, the number one killer of children across South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Torit.
A major requirement of the annual Mandela Washington Fellowship is that fellows return to their country and implement lessons learned in the U.S. Some South Sudanese fellows say the recent fighting at home has complicated their plans. When they arrived here back in June, there was no fighting in Juba, but now that's all changed. Ayen Bior has more from Washington.
When South Sudanese Mandela Washington fellows left Juba in mid-June, Riek Machar was still the first vice president, and thousands of refugees were not pouring into neighboring countries, trying to escape the violence that broke out in early July. Some of the fellows said they had to take time off from studying so they could try to reach out to loved ones back home during the crisis. All of them say they've been worried about the deadly attacks that occurred in Juba, which had a ripple effect on communities where their families lived. The fellows had to decide if they were going to head back home during the instability or figure out another path. 25-year-old Tuna Stella Starr, a legal aid officer in eastern Equatoria and one of South Sudan's 14 Mandela Washington fellows, says for her, the decision was easy.
Home is where your people are, and I wouldn't feel happy here. When the situation happened, I felt like going back. I was like, I'd rather suffer with my people than be somewhere looking at something from far. It pains more. You'd rather be there. I would say everyone feels scared, yeah. But that's our home. We can't run away. We are here to go make a change. That is why we came here.
Bena Mark, a 30-year-old lecturer at Juba University, says she was horrified when the news broke about fresh fighting in the capital. She says she couldn't help but think back to December 2013, when the conflict erupted and her family feared for their lives. The main difference last month was that she was thousands of miles away from her family, studying public management at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, located in the Midwest part of the United States. Mark says the most important lesson she has learned in the U.S. is how to actively listen to people, which she says will help her be a better teacher when she returns home in 6 weeks. While she has not wavered on her plans to return home, Mark says she understands it's a hard decision for all South Sudanese Mandela Fellows to make.
And then also we felt with the pain that our brothers and sisters are going through in South Sudan, that when we are here drinking clean water, sleeping in a very clean room, and others are still under the trees, it is meaningless to stay and enjoy such kind of luxurious life. We better go home and sleep with them under the trees so that we share our burden together and see the way forward towards such problems.
32-year-old Mandela Fellow Sebit Nicholas hails from Ye and is studying civic leadership here in the U.S. He says when he returns to South Sudan, he will implement the lessons of leadership, as exemplified by U.S. President Barack Obama and his professors at Duquesne University in the East Coast state of Pennsylvania. Nicholas says his plans to return to Ye have been postponed by the recent violence. His family is among the 52,000 South Sudanese refugees who fled to Uganda during last month's fighting. He says listening to Mr. Obama and meeting like-minded, energetic Africans convinced him that he cannot allow further violence to distract him from his passion of helping his people. Nicholas bought a plane ticket to Uganda, where he plans to make his way to camps hosting his people.
I want to go to the refugee camps where our South Sudanese are. I know that some of them might have come with the bitterness. They have lost properties. They have lost their loved ones. I need to be there as a young person to support them, to stand with them, to advocate for services that needs to be given to them, especially by the international agencies that are working with people who are displaced, because that is their right.
25-year-old Ladjorga Dare's fellowship has been extended for another 6 weeks, but he's already bought a plane ticket back to South Sudan for the end of September. During his time here, Gadir hopes to perfect a machine he invented that will deliver clean water to his community. He says the machine is in the early stages, but it does not require electricity or a generator to work. He hopes the Mandela Fellowship professors and engineers he's working with will help him fine-tune his invention. And Gadir says he is determined to return home.
Actually, I'm very optimistic that things will normalize. I know things will normalize very soon. It's just kind of that misunderstanding, and if the regional leaders intervene and they try to bring them together, I think it is very simple. They will try to solve that problem and things will normalize and I'll go back home. I'm so optimistic to go back home and take all this knowledge that I've gained here in the U.S. I have to give back to the community. I have to make change. I have to know that I have a responsibility. I should be having that feeling of belongingness to the community.
For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
From Washington, we go to Ethiopia, where the death toll from weekend protests in Ethiopia has climbed to nearly 100 people. Hundreds of people have also reportedly been arrested and many have been injured. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig talks to analysts about the protesters' grievances and what the future may hold.
Protests in the Oromia and Amhara regions on Saturday and Sunday left dozens dead and hundreds injured. Amnesty International puts the number of fatalities at 97. Opposition parties and human rights groups say Ethiopian security forces opened fire on anti-government protesters who were unarmed and peaceful. The government tells a different story, saying some protesters carried lethal weapons, including explosives, and that the opposition was organizing unauthorized protests by forces of violence. Despite their simultaneous demonstrations, the Oromo and Amhara do not have the same grievances, says Fasaha Tekle, a human rights researcher at Amnesty International's regional office.
In Oromia region, the immediate cause for the protest was about the master plan that expanded the border of the city towards Oromia. And in Amhara region, it was about the arrest of the five members of the World Kites Identity and Self-Determination Committee. So these are the immediate causes that has sparked the demonstration and the opposition rally.
In the Oromia region, people began protesting in November 2015 against a government master plan that would annex parts of their land to Addis Ababa, the capital city. The plan was officially put on hold, but people have still been demonstrating. In the weekend violence, Amnesty International says at least 67 people were killed in 12 cities and towns. In the Amhara region, reports suggest at least 30 people were killed in the capital, Bahar Dar, over the weekend. The opposition had canceled a planned rally after saying officials did not give authorization, but protesters still came out to support the Oromia people and ask the government to address local issues. One grievance had already surfaced in July when security forces tried to arrest a leader of the Walkite Identity and Self-Determination Committee on alleged terrorism charges. The Walkite Administrative District was formally part of the Amhara region until 1991, when the ruling party took charge. In subsequent years, it has demanded reintegration. Fred Nyabera works with child anti-poverty group Arigatou International. He believes that the common bond between the Oromo and the Amhara is their inability to express their grievances to the government.
I think partly, according to my thinking, is that there's always been a shrinking space for civil society organizations and alternative voice in Ethiopia generally. And people might have different grievances, but they don't have space to air it out.
Awu Alu, a fellow in human rights at the London School of Economics, says that the groups are now starting to come together after historically being pitted against one another.
But what really happened over the course of the last 1 year is that people on both sides tried to come together and sort out the sort of things that prevent them from having a conversation from one another. So there are already very interesting expressions of solidarity between the Oromos and the Amharas.
But no one, including Amnesty's Fasaha Tekle, is quite sure what the future will hold.
It depends on the government. If the government is going to let people demonstrate, express their opinion and opposition, the situation will kind of improve. But if the government is going to continue the use of excessive force, the situation will remain there or it may even degenerate.
The government continues to warn against protests, which it says could lead to destabilization. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Omega by Victoria Ole. We have been listening to Victoria Ole and the song Omega, praising the power of a woman. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.